and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Trump's rally in Iowa on Saturday, at which the state's top Republican politicians and Senator Grassley, who had previously been critical of Trump holding him responsible for the January 6th insurrection, groveled before the leader of the GOP, who was clearly making a run for the presidency in 2024. Joining us is Aaron Rupa, who until recently was the associate editor for politics and policy at Vox and is now an independent journalist covering U.S. politics and media. He's the author of Public Notice, a newsletter which you can subscribe to at aaronrupa.substack.com. And his latest articles there are Thoughts on Trump's Rally in Des Moines and the Value of Trump's Coverage More Broadly, and What Trump is Really Saying in His Ashley Babbitt Birthday Video. We'll discuss the more brazen racism Trump is now expressing on the stump against Haitians and Afghan refugees, and the challenge the press has in covering Trump, who was given up to $5 billion in free advertising by the press in 2016. Now Trump cannot be seen as a political postscript, since his looming presence dominating the Republican Party instead is the prelude to the end of American democracy. Then we'll speak with Fiona Hill, a senior fellow in the Center on the United States and Europe in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. She recently served as Deputy Assistant to the President and Senior Director for European and Russian Affairs on the National Security Council from 2017 to 2019, and from 2006 to 2009 served as National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council. She's the co-author of Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin, and The Siberian Curse, How Communist Planners Left Russia Out in the Cold. Her latest book, just out, is There Is Nothing For You Here, Finding Opportunity in the 21st Century, and we will discuss her concern that we are at a really critical and very dangerous inflection point, and if Trump makes a successful return to the presidency in 2024 on the back of a lie, a fiction, American democracy is done. Then finally, we'll speak with Justin Vaughn, the vice president of GS Strategy Group, who until recently was a professor of political science at Boise State University, where he also served as director of the Center for Idaho History and Politics. He joins us to discuss how Idaho's lieutenant governor, an avid Trumpster, is grabbing the reins of power to issue edicts whenever the more traditional Republican governor leaves town, setting up a clash between the old and the new GOP. And before we go to our first guest, while Background Briefing remains a nationally syndicated radio program with a growing national and international audience, we are relying more and more on our online and podcast audience to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program alive during the critical years ahead in which the fate of American democracy will be decided. For those of you who can, help us keep delivering a daily briefing so those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate can also join in the fight against disinformation, whether it comes from Mar-a-Lago or Moscow. We must win the political warfare battles underway and fight with weaponized facts to save our democracy as we create a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Aaron Rupa, who until recently was associate editor for politics and policy at Vox and is now an independent journalist covering U.S. politics and media. He's the author of Public Note, a newsletter which you can subscribe to at aaronrupa.substack.com. And his latest articles there are Thoughts on Trump's Rally at Des Moines and the Value of Trump's Coverage More Broadly and What Trump is Really Saying in His Ashley Babbitt Birthday Video. Welcome to Background Briefing. Aaron Rupa.
Great to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And the rally that Trump had in Iowa, and of course that's where politicians start out their presidential runs, was pretty disgusting, I guess, in a way, to have these politicians, in particular Charles Grassley, who was very clear in denouncing Trump after January the 6th and holding him responsible. And there he was on stage being completely supine and sucking up to Trump and saying, you know, I wouldn't be too smart if I went against somebody with a 91% approval rating. So I guess that's the problem, right? Trump has a 91% approval rating amongst Republicans.
Yeah, in that sense, it was kind of a microcosm of what Republican politics have been this year, where, you know, there was that brief window after January 6th where, you know, it seemed like Kevin McCarthy, Mitch McConnell, Chuck Grassley, there was an effort to put some distance between themselves and Trump for obvious reasons. But, you know, as the GOP base stuck with Trump, the pressure has been on these Republicans to kind of fall in line behind him. And, you know, it wasn't just the quote from Grassley that you just mentioned that he said on stage when he accepted Trump's endorsement for his reelection campaign, but it was also before the rally, which I get into in the piece a little bit too. Grassley went on Newsmax and basically tried to turn January 6th upside down, saying that Trump is basically a victim of a witch hunt being conducted by the January 6th committee, because he, in Grassley's interpretation, you know, was the person who actually tried to stop other officials in government from trying to overturn the election results. Never mind that we have, you know, a recording of a phone call in which Trump is asking officials in Georgia to find votes for him. So, you know, it's not even just, you know, as bad as it would be if people like Grassley were just kind of ignoring January 6th, pretending it didn't happen. But he's going even further and, you know, kind of, you know, turning that whole day, everything that happened leading up to it upside down. And in that sense, kind of rewriting history. So, yeah, I mean, I thought Grassley's behavior, you know, before and during that rally was kind of a microcosm of what we've seen, you know, of what the story of Republican politics more broadly this year.
So he's following in line behind House Minority Leader McCarthy and others.
Yeah, I mean, this has been the story of Trump for 5 years, is that, you know, ultimately these Republicans, McCarthy, McConnell, I mean, there's a sense in which they're afraid of their own voters, where, you know, if they kind of got out on that limb of denouncing Trump, they would open themselves up to a primary from a Trump-backed candidate, a Marjorie Taylor Greene type. And so, you know, I think that's just kind of putting their finger up and sensing where the political wind is blowing. And at this point, if you want to be a member in good standing of the Republican Party, you have to support Trump. And so, you know, it wasn't just Grassley. There was also Kim Reynolds, the governor of Iowa, got on stage in Des Moines to introduce Trump. There were two Republican members of Congress who got on stage to endorse Trump. And so that was one of the things beyond Trump's speech, which was kind of more of the same. You know, he's really leaning into familiar racist tropes regarding Haitian migrants, regarding Afghan refugees. But so that, you know, it's still notable, obviously, that the leader of the Republican Party is saying stuff like that, pushing the same sort of bigotry that, you know, he's pushed for years now. But the thing that really stood out to me is just what it symbolized in terms of how united rank and file Republicans are behind Trump.
But let's touch on the racism, because it's pretty raw what he said about Afghan refugees coming over here essentially as terrorists, and also Haitians having AIDS. I mean, I know he started off his campaign in 2016 going down the elevator in Trump Tower, labeling the Mexicans as murderers and rapists. But do you think that as this campaign gets underway, because it seems hardly an accident that this happened in Iowa where these presidential campaigns start, this is a guy, I mean, is he running out of vengeance? Remember, a lot of pundits think the reason he ran in the first place in 2016 was because of the humiliation meted out by Obama at the White House press dinner, at which he made fun of Trump, and that was happened to be the same night that Obama had killed bin Laden. Mm-hmm. That's a theory, at least. And so you could make the case that Trump ran in 2016 out of vengeance. It seems like he's running for 2024 out of vengeance as well. What's motivating this, apart from the fact that it might be a grift?
Yeah, well, there is that part of it. I mean, there's, you know, the fundraising that he was doing after the election for his leadership PAC, and there's very few regulations on how that money can be spent, so he can basically hold events at his own properties and reimburse himself. And so there is the financial part of it, and I don't think we should dismiss that. I do think vengeance is probably a part of it, and I think ego is a part of it too, just the sense that, you know, he was rejected in some sense by voters and trying to sort of correct that, you know. And I think there's also just the part of it that he enjoys campaigning. He enjoys these rallies, feeds off the energy that the crowd provides him. And, you know, that was something that I really took note of watching his rally on Saturday, is that he devoted a large part of his speech to the big lie and to kind of ticking through, you know, very specific instances of alleged irregularities or fraud, you know, most of these claims already being debunked or being kind of unfalsifiable. It's not like there's a lot of merit to what he's saying. But the thing that I thought was really noteworthy is that his audience seemed pretty bored with that part of the speech. You know, I posted a couple clips where, you know, he talked for 90 seconds about some alleged fraud in Michigan or something like that. And the crowd is just kind of sitting there silently. And it seemed like there is still kind of more energy for the tried and true kind of race baiting that you alluded to, you know, whether it's talking about Afghan refugees, Haitian migrants, talking about the need to build the border wall to, you know, correct the crisis at the southern border right now, that sort of stuff. So, you know, it seemed like those, you know, that material played better with his audience in Iowa than the big lie stuff. And so that's something I'll be keeping an eye on as he holds more of these events, just, you know, the sort of response he gets. Because certainly I think, you know, all indications at this point are that the big lie is going to be a big part of his political identity going forward. And it's kind of the founding myth of his 2024 campaign, this sense that the presidency was stolen from him. And, you know, it is kind of a redemption tour of sorts to try and rectify that wrong, at least in his mind. But it seems like, you know, like I said, the audience wasn't that jazzed up by that. And that could just be the way that he kind of presented that stuff. But, you know, that's a big part of the appeal of Trump has been these rallies and kind of the sense that, you know, it's a big political movement and the charisma that he has on stage and all of that sort of stuff. And so, you know, if it continues to be the case that he holds these rallies and kind of ticks through all of these conspiracy theories about election fraud and no one really responds to it, you know, I'm sure he'll adjust his material. But it did seem like there was a whole section of the speech, as you alluded to, that was devoted to kind of the classic race baiting and, you know, the ugly comments about refugees and migrants and all that sort of stuff. And so in that sense, you know, one of the things that I really took away from that is that a lot of this stuff with Trump isn't new. And so people are kind of numb to it. You know, it barely kind of makes the news that he's out there saying these horrible things about Afghan refugees and Haitian migrants, but it's still very notable. And so I think, you know, that's one of the things in this piece, when I'm talking about kind of lessons learned covering Trump these days versus when he was president, is that it's important to keep that distinction in mind, that just because something isn't newsworthy doesn't mean it's not notable, especially when we're talking about someone who is the presumptive Republican presidential nominee and the leader of the Republican Party.
But Aaron, it's been widely reported that Trump got up to $5 billion worth of free advertising in 2016. And from the mainstream media, and I remember the head of CBS said, well, he may not be good for the country, but he's good for the ratings, or something along those lines. So let's talk a little bit about the dilemma of covering him at all. You can't ignore him. And early on, the Huffington Post tried to do that, and they didn't get very far with that. So what do you do? Because of all this toxicity that's pouring out of him, along with trying to turn the people like Ashley Babbitt's, these traitors into heroes and martyrs, that's obviously a real challenge, isn't it? I mean, the fact that he's been cut off from Twitter apparently has really hurt him. And, you know, he's looking for other ways to get attention. And what's the point of helping him?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I have any perfect answers to this. I do think it's a very thorny question, you know, just how journalists, including myself, cover this guy at this point. You know, just for me, what I try to you know, the context that I try to bring, or the principles I try to bring to covering him, is to be mindful of, you know, newsworthiness, what represents news and what doesn't. And, you know, what I mean by that is, you know, I do see reporters who I generally, you know, have respect for and think do good work, kind of rushing to Twitter whenever Trump blasts out one of these email statements that are chock full of lies and smears, and kind of mindlessly, you know, amplifying them, retweeting them, which helps Trump circumvent his Twitter ban, because you're basically, he's tweeting through these reporters. He's using them to get his messaging out there. And so I don't think that's very constructive. I do think that sort of thing provides him with oxygen and free publicity in a sense that is counterproductive. But, you know, on the other hand, when you're talking about the leader of the Republican Party, there is kind of an inherent newsworthiness to much of what he says and to what happens at these rallies. And so, you know, I just think you have to be kind of sensitive to context in that way. But, you know, again, the main thing I try to be mindful of is not to allow him to use me as kind of a vessel to get his messaging out there. Specifically with the Ashley Babbitt thing, you know, the reason that I thought that was worth covering is that this video that he recorded for Ashley Babbitt's birthday celebration was basically, when you kind of deconstruct it, an endorsement of political violence, because he is glorifying this woman who was part of the mob that was ransacking the Capitol and trying to lay hands on members of Congress that day. And so, again, when you have a influential politician, a, you know, serious presidential candidate and a former president endorsing that sort of thing, I think that's a very notable moment and something worth covering. But I think, you know, one thing that I do mention in the piece is that I do think, in general, reporters by the end of the Trump presidency had gotten a lot better about calling him out. You know, I think we can all think back to the coverage of a lot of, for instance, Trump's attacks last campaign cycle on mail voting, and how by the end of that, I thought that reporters, even, you know, from outlets like the New York Times and Washington Post, were doing a good job putting Trump's claims in context, debunking them, calling his lies lies when it's appropriate. And so, you know, I think there was improvement. It, you know, it wasn't perfect, but there was improvement from 2016. And so, you know, I think those have to be kind of the best practices going forward, just making sure that you're not doing stenography for him, but that you're putting his claims in context, evaluating them, and, you know, not amplifying smears and falsehoods.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Aaron. And I, for the life of me, I don't understand the 91% approval, why he's supported with such energy by the Republican base. We don't quite know what the percentage is, but it's at least a third of the country. It is mystifying, given what an appallingly incompetent president with such a just a devastating record, not to mention 700,000 dead Americans from COVID. That's the mystifying part, and I guess we'll maybe we should try and revisit that if you have any
we'll
answers
have to
that
another
one.
Time. Yeah, you could write a book on that, I think. But yeah, I mean, I'm equally somewhat flummoxed by it. I mean, obviously there have been some challenges here in this first year for President Biden, much of it not his own fault, but, you know, I think some of the softening of the economy and the resurgence of COVID have kind of created space for Trump to try and sort of rewrite the history of his own term in office. And right. So, you know, I wouldn't put a ton of stock in the poll that you mentioned, these kind of internal polls of primary voters. I don't know. You know, I don't know how much we can really infer from that, but I do agree with you that it is troubling that despite what we all lived through, you know, there is this sense shared among a good swath of the country that, you know, this guy should run again and that he would make a good president for a second term. So, yeah, I'm bothered by that as well.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Aaron Ruper. And again, Aaron Ruper, until recently, was associate editor for politics and policy at Vox, and he's now an independent journalist covering U.S. politics and media. He's the author of Public Notice, a newsletter which you can subscribe to at aaronruper.substack.com. And his latest articles there are Thoughts on Trump's Rally in Des Moines and The Value of Trump's Coverage More Broadly, and What Trump is Really Saying in His Ashley Babbitt Birthday Video. We're going to take a brief station break and back speaking with Fiona Hill about her concerns that if Trump makes a successful return to the presidency in 2024 on the back of a lie, a fiction, American democracy is done. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Fiona Hill, a senior fellow at the Center on the United States and Europe in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. She recently served as Deputy Assistant to the President and Senior Director for European and Russian Affairs on the National Security Council from 2017 to 2019, and from 2006 to 2009 served as the National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council. She has researched and published extensively on issues related to Russia, the Caucasus, Central Asia, regional conflicts, energy, and strategic issues, and is the co-author of Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin, and The Siberian Curse, How Communist Planners Left Russia Out in the Cold. And her latest book just out is There's Nothing for You Here, Finding Opportunity in the 21st Century. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fiona Hill.
Oh, thanks so much, Ian. Great to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And the title of your new book, of course, is What Your Father Said to You in this sort of post-industrial decay in the north of England with the coal miners largely unemployed. Your grandfather was badly injured in the coal mines, and he's telling you there's nothing for you here, and that prompted you to what? Go to Russia and then on to the United States?
Well, it's also prompted me to, you know, go on to university and also try to seek an education. I probably overfulfilled the plan because, I mean, my dad had left school at 14, like many other people from his background, pushed to go down the mines to put money on the table and, you know, kind of get out to work as soon as possible. And he'd always really regretted not being able to continue with his education. He'd actually enjoyed school. But, you know, kind of he was pushed out, and he spent quite a lot of time sort of seeking self-edification and education, going to miners' reading circles and like kind of book clubs almost that were kind of set up by some of the local churches and the Durham Miners Association, and generally, you know, trying to read newspapers and keep engaged. And so he was basically saying to me, look, I would have loved to have had an educational opportunity. I never had it. You should go out and take it. But that overall message was, you know, there's nothing for you here in terms of job prospects and life opportunities, because all of the industry was closing down. Even, you know, if it had been open as a girl, I wouldn't have been following my dad down the mines, of course. But the whole prospects in the north of England were pretty grim. And in fact, you know, you coming from, you know, Australia yourself, Ian, a number of my relatives emigrated to Australia in that time frame, you know, to go and work in the industry in Australia because they were recruiting. And others moved to the United States and Canada and elsewhere in the world. And my dad himself thought about moving to the United States to work in a coal mine in either Pennsylvania or West Virginia.
And you have a chapter in your new book, From the Coal House to the White House. But nevertheless, this extraordinary journey you've taken, you consider it a fluke?
Well, yes, coming from that kind of background in the north of England, in that period, you know, that kind of social mobility across class lines was pretty unheard of. There are, you know, people from my background out there in the UK in positions, but they're few and far between. In some cases, you know, they tend to be actually in entertainment industry, a lot of comedians, actors, actresses, you know, from the north of England. You know, quite a few made it to Hollywood, you know, people who people might recognize, character actors, but very few in the upper reaches of politics, unless they went from, you know, local politics and then through the unions, for example, into the Labour Party, very unlikely to have made it on the other side of the political aisle in the UK. And very few people in business from these kinds of backgrounds. Lots of musicians, rock musicians, you know, for example, someone like Sting is from the northeast of England, from Wall's End near Newcastle. His dad was a milkman, you know, for the area around the local shipyards. Brian Ferry from Roxy Music, maybe a bit old for some of the listeners, you know, kind of, but, you know, pretty famous back in the 70s and 80s. His family were coal miners from the same region as I'm from. But it was unlikely for someone to set themselves up on a professional career, and certainly to end up in some of the places that I have.
So let's turn to your, after St. Andrews, you went to Moscow, and you were there in the, what, the late 80s?
Because
Donald Trump made his first trip to Moscow in July the 4th of 1987. Were you there at that time?
I arrived there in September, so he beat me just by a couple of months. I was there by September 1987. I mean, that was, you know, the peak of perestroika, the Gorbachev-Reagan summits of arms control. And I'd started to study Russian in 1984 against the backdrop of the nuclear standoff, the Cold War war scare over the stationing of SS-20 and Pershing missiles in Europe. And, you know, that was the whole period where all eyes were on the Soviet Union. Everybody was fascinated by Gorbachev and, you know, what he could potentially do. And yes, that's when I ended up there, September 1987, to study for a year.
And when Donald Trump returned from that first trip, which was sponsored by the Soviet Foreign Ministry, and with the lure, by the way, of building a Trump Tower in Moscow, the same lure that was dangled again in 2016 by Felix Sater and others.
Right.
Nevertheless, when he got back to the United States, he took out full-page ads in the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the Boston Globe, essentially parroting Russian propaganda. What do you think that was about?
Well, look, he's not the only one. Many people who went to the Soviet Union or to Russia in different times were, persuaded that, things were going smoothly and swimmingly there, particularly in somebody who, wanted to do some business there, to build a building, as you laid out, people who, had political interests that dovetailed with some of the positions that the Russians and Soviets were putting out. I mean, there's a long history of the Soviet Union, and that was still the Soviet Union in the 1980s, inviting over people from marginalized, persecuted groups, the famous black tenor Paul Robeson and many other musicians and singers and actors and actresses who are African-American who were invited out in the 20s and 30s because they'd literally been persecuted back at home or ostracized, a whole host of others at different time frames. I mean, this is something that the Soviet Union did, and modern Russia does too, invite groups over to put themselves in the best light with the expectation that they will come back home again and report favorably on what they've seen. I wrote a book about Vladimir Putin in 2013 and again in 2015 when I updated it. And I'd also been invited, like many others, to take part in something called the Valdai Discussion Club, which is still going on, that invited experts, academics, reporters, journalists over to Russia with the express intention on the part of our hosts. They made it incredibly directly apparent that we would go back and feel, kind of compelled to say something positive about the experience.
And again, I'm speaking with Fiona Hill, a senior fellow in the Center on the United States and Europe in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. She recently served as Deputy Assistant to the President and Senior Director for European and Russian Affairs on the National Security Council from 2017 to 2019, and from 2006 to 2009 served as National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia on the National Intelligence Council, and she's the author of Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin, and The Siberian Curse, How Communist Planners Left Russia Out in the Cold. And her latest book, just out, is There's Nothing for You Here, Finding Opportunity in the 21st Century. So moving forward to 2016, as you point out in your book, President Vladimir Putin unleashed the Russian security services to intervene in the 2016 elections. And at that time, when it became apparent to the Obama administration, Obama tried to get McConnell and Paul Ryan and the other Democratic counterparts together and come up with a joint statement. McConnell refused to do that. In retrospect, I wonder why Obama still didn't go public and warn that Russia was interfering at that point, certainly in the early stages of the 2016 elections. A lot of talk about the Steele dossier, but that seems to be a distraction. There was some pretty hard evidence, wasn't there, that Obama was basing that meeting on. There was a fellow called Oleg Smolenkov, who was exfiltrated out of Russia, who had been the chief aide to the deputy foreign minister. He had access to Putin's desk. So what happened at that moment? Do you think that was a mistake on the part of Obama not to warn the American public that Russia's interference was going on early on? Would that have been a deterrent to Putin's actions?
I don't think it would have been a deterrent to Putin's actions because he would have denied it, as he's continued to do so. I think it was the challenge, as you always have in these cases, is how to warn, and what the warning will also do to your ability to push back against it. Because, once a warning is issued and, you have to say how you know this, of course, then the ways and the channels in which you're getting these information become closed off. But at the same time, it seems very evident from, some of the reporting around the time and just from myself talking to people behind the scenes that, there was kind of a worry right away about the politicization of this information, that it might be seen to be interfering in the election. Because what were the Russians trying to do? They were clearly trying to subvert the whole election process, cast a poll over and a big question mark over the whole election and its legitimacy. They were targeting a number of campaigns. I mean, this is, something in the end that, I am concerned about, that we didn't get a full accounting of all the things that they were attempting to do. It wasn't that they were just trying to denigrate Hillary Clinton and, promote the candidacy of Trump. They'd actually been actively out there trying to infiltrate and get information and try to influence all of the campaigns of the major contenders. They weren't expecting Donald Trump to emerge as the kind of the wild card candidate, the last man standing out of such a large array of Republican candidates, and they'd try to get their way into other campaigns during the primaries. And in terms of, you know, Hillary Clinton, their main goal was, of course, to denigrate her and to, you know, basically push out even further a lot of the information that was being produced by domestic political operatives. I mean, one of the things to bear in mind about the Russians is they don't always just invent information. What they'll do is exploit what's out there, and they will amplify it, particularly negative information. And, you know, the hack and release of Hillary Clinton's emails and the DNC's emails, the Democratic, you know, National Committee, that was probably one of the most damaging acts that they did. You know, everything from, you know, revealing the inner wranglings around her candidacy and Bernie Sanders, you know, the kind of back and forth of individuals about what they thought about each other. This was all, you know, clearly designed to tie people up in knots and sort of, you know, damage people's reputations. So what the Russians do is they use what's there.
Well, of course, the data dump, that happened through WikiLeaks, and it essentially took off the headlines that damaging Access Hollywood tapes.
Absolutely, yeah.
So that's hardly coincidental.
Well, no, the Russians, it's, you know, a lot of this stuff isn't coincidental because they're watching very closely our own politics. And look, remember, they created false personas on the internet, you know, posing as Americans on Facebook and elsewhere. And they were out to damage, you know, Clinton as much as they could. And they happened to be acting in parallel, you know, with other political actors in our own domestic system, including President Trump and his campaign, were out to damage her too. She was the person to beat. And in the Russian case, they wanted to beat her up. And so, you know, in the anticipation she would become president, have a big question over her legitimacy and her credibility.
But did they get lucky with Trump, or was there some design there? Because I'm sure Putin thought that Trump would lose, like everybody else did.
Sure.
But he still had it covered, and he had plan B, did he not, which would be Trump running around the country leading rallies of lock her up, lock her up.
So well, that was certainly Trump's plan B. So from the Russians' perspective, all of this is win-win. And the more that we suggest that, you know, they won the election for Trump, the bigger the win they have, because of what an astounding proposition that, right, you know, the former Soviet spies, now new Russian spies, can actually manipulate the outcome of an American election. I mean, that's giving them the biggest win of all by, you know, even saying that. And, you know, part of the, you know, reason for writing the book is also, you know, to point out that that actually lets us off the hook in the United States. I mean, a lot of people want to believe that Trump was elected by Vladimir Putin and his manipulation of his security service manipulation of the election, because they don't want to lock down, you know, kind of around them, you know, the circumstances that produced Trump in the first place, the mismanagement of the campaign by a whole host of other Republican candidates, the grievances, you know, in the country that Trump was able to tap into. You know, I think Putin was just quicker than most to recognize, you know, the potential of Trump because he's a populist leader. Trump was, you know, doing many of the same things that Putin had done, or that leaders in other countries that Putin's already, you know, gotten his crosshairs have been doing. Trump was, you know, in many respects, you know, as he's suggesting, a kind of a bit of a godsend in a way, because he was just this unique populist character, very focused in on himself, not focused in on the United States and its interests, ignorant of, you know, a lot of the larger dynamics of the relationships, and incredibly easy to manipulate.
But the circumstances that allowed Trump to flourish, you write a lot about, and that is this sort of post-industrial Rust Belt, you know, having come from the North of England equivalent, and the disaffection and the alienation. Obviously, Putin is exploiting fissures that already exist here in the United States, and the extent to which this continues, I wonder, you know, you pose the question of whether we thought that there was a postscript after Biden got elected, but maybe we have a preface here for a continuation of these divisions. I mean, could you make the case that Trump is the gift that keeps on giving?
Well, I think you've just made the case very, very well there, Ian. Exactly. You know, one of the main points of the exercise of unleashing the security services was to discredit the United States as a global actor. You know, we'd spent an awful lot of time. One of the precipitating events for this, for Putin, it's kind of like a bit of a vengeance exercise for him, was when he decided to return to the Russian presidency in 2011, 2012, having stepped away for a period after two terms as president. You know, he wasn't under the constitution at that point allowed to run for office again as president. So he steps away to be prime minister. He puts in his close associate, Dmitry Medvedev, into the presidency, you know, I mean, with some show of an election. And then he's deciding to come back again because he doesn't like the way things are unfolding. And Hillary Clinton, among many other world figures, because she's then the Secretary of State, is very vociferous in her opposition, her criticism of Putin. And Putin seems to firmly believe that Clinton, in her role as Secretary of State and the U.S. State Department, the embassy in Moscow, were basically pushing programs to thwart his re-election because they were, you know, promoting programs of transparency in elections and election oversight. And of course, the United States always used to make, you know, very strong international pronouncements on the nature of elections, whether they were free or fair, how well they were conducted. And I think, you know, basically Putin wanted to say, well, let's see, you know, right back at you, how you feel about having so many questions about the legitimacy of your elections or someone intervening, you know, to mess up your election. So, you know, in a way, he was hoping to kind of push everything right back at us again and, you know, in many respects succeeded, probably beyond his wildest dreams because of the acute vulnerability to manipulation, all of the grievances that we've just talked about, and the fragility of our political systems with this acute polarization, fights within the Republican Party. I mean, you've got to remember that Donald Trump, in a way, you know, usurps the Republican Party because the 17 other candidates are all fighting among themselves. The Republican Party also fighting among Democratic Party, rather, with big fights between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders on the one hand. I mean, basically patterns that are still there in the parties between the left and, you know, the kind of right parts of each of the parties. So, you know, Putin was just kind of walking in through a whole set of open doors using social media, you know, Americans' propensity to just kind of not read what they're posting and sending on to friends and relatives. It was just an incredibly fertile environment. And as you said, it still is.
Well, that's where it's quite alarming. And you, in an interview that you did with Politico recently, Fiona, you suggested that if Trump is reelected in 2024, it'll be game over for American democracy. It's beginning to be game over already, irrespective of Trump's presidential ambitions. And he went to Iowa on Saturday, which is pretty telling. The Republican Party itself, which is very much Trump's party, the voter suppression that's underway is so multi-layered. Through gerrymandering alone, they'll probably pick up the House before one vote is taken. They've got the possibility on Election Day of all kinds of voter suppression. And then after Election Day, they've got, in many key states, through Republican legislatures, they've got the ability to count and certify the vote. If they don't like it, they can overturn it. And then you've got Steve Bannon's operation at the level of the precincts, where they're driving out traditionally neutral poll workers and bringing in the kind of crazy partisans that you saw with the cyber ninjas in Arizona. So already we have creeping authoritarianism in terms of the possibility that through the rigging of the elections, irrespective of Trump, that we could be heading towards a one-party state.
You're describing, you know, kind of very vividly and accurately, you know, what I talk in the book of the authoritarian's playbook. You know, what's happened in other countries where we've seen the same progression of, you know, kind of more neutral bodies pushed out of the way, a more partisan tenor to all of the elections, independent election officials and judges removed from office, and, you know, one political party, the ruling party, eclipsing everything else. You're describing, you know, what happened in Russia in the 2000s since Vladimir Putin came along. You're describing, you know, what's been happening. We've been seeing in somewhere like Hungary, you know, where the European Union is sort of grappling with an illiberal direction that Hungary's taken. You know, similar, you know, developments that have been, you know, happening to some extent in Poland, you know, for example. But it's more, you know, kind of the tenor of politics in Latin American countries or, you know, in other parts of the world, but just not something that we're used to seeing in the United States. And you've got your, you know, finger right on it, on the pulse of what's happening here. This is why it's so incredibly dangerous. And if, you know, members of the party that are trying to pervert the electoral system in these kinds of directions to stay in power, you don't stand up for democracy, then there's, you know, it becomes extraordinarily difficult, you know, for others to push back. Pushback would have to come, you know, at the state and local government level. But, you know, we've already seen, and the newspapers are full of articles about the nationalization of our local politics, where, you know, kind of places like Wisconsin or Arizona or, you know, Georgia have become the proving and fighting grounds for things that are happening on the national stage.
Well, with something like 80% of Republicans believing that Trump won, and this the big lie metastasizing the way that it is, and that the real threat of Trump running again in 2024, and frankly, he's laid the groundwork. So no matter what the voters say in 2024, if indeed he is the Republican candidate, he'll still declare himself the winner. So
sure.
This is where it gets mystifying, is why is there any support at all? Your book paints a portrait of this absolutely outrageous, incompetent amateur out of his depth. I mean, he got rolled by Xi, he got rolled by Putin, he got rolled by Erdogan, he got rolled by the Taliban, for God's sake, and 700,000 Americans are dead because of his incompetence from COVID. Yet there is this extraordinary amount of support. Is that, I mean, I'm looking around for an explanation for that. Is it that we have the American equivalent of Surkoff in Murdoch and Fox? What explains the grip that he has over at least a third of the country?
Well, I think there are a number of things that explain it. And I do, you know, lay out in the book where, you know, many people saw him as their champion, you know, somebody, the anti-establishment figure, you know, coming out to try to, you know, fix things for them, just like Putin presented himself in Russia. And, you know, for many people, they did feel that he fixed a lot for them. I mean, if people who were, you know, really interested in having conservative judges appointed across the country into the Supreme Court, they got what they wanted. Because you've got to remember, an awful lot of people in the United States have single issues that they, you know, that they vote on, or that they have their adherence to a political party. A lot of people, you know, got what they wanted. Very wealthy Americans who didn't want to pay taxes, businesses who wanted to, you know, see deregulation and the United States to pull out of the Paris Peace Accord, you know, on climate change, for example. There was a lot of things for people to want on a practical level. Then there's the more sort of psychological aspect of it. I mean, we, you know, kind of know that President Trump is incredibly narcissistic, very self-absorbed. I saw that over and over again, as I describe in the book. He was always Trump first, not America first. But he also has a charisma that, you know, for people who kind of see him in action, you know, they find him, you know, very alluring is the only way to put it. Basically, there's a part in the book about the allure of Trump. He's a big guy. Yeah, he's lived the life. He's selling himself and his lifestyle of the rich and famous. A lot of people look into that saying, yeah, I want to be that. He's kind of like their avatar in, you know, a game of life. They would like to be out there and, you know, kind of basically strut about and say what they want to say, do what they want to do, have the beautiful life. He's extraordinarily good at selling things. He honed his craft in reality television. So, and he's transferred into really, you know, very clever retail politics. He's in constant campaign mode. He's always out there in rallies, just like he was, you know, recently in Iowa, whipping up the cloud. He's a performer. He's an entertainer. Again, it's like an avatar in this video game. People project on him, you know, what they would like to sort of see themselves doing. He's the big finger to the aloof elites who have disrespected people and talked past them all the time and taken their votes for granted. There's a sort of a complexity there. And then when it comes to congressional Republicans in the House and in the Senate, he's told them, he's bullied them. He's told them that, you know, if you go after me, you're not loyal to me, I'm going to have you kicked out of office. I'm going to after you, and I'm going to get loyalists put in your place because I'm going to turn all the voters about against you. Because there is no Republican Party, he's saying. There's no congressional Republican Party. There's only the party of Trump. And so he's bullied and frightened and intimidated people. Some of them are telling themselves, well, if I leave office, if I quit and I go, well, who else is he going to put in place? I've got to, you know, they're telling themselves that they're sort of saving the country. And others are like, I can't imagine myself going off and not being in Congress or not in the Senate. I've done this my whole life, my whole professional life. How could, this is me, this is my own identity. And he's threatening that for them. But I mean, this is one of those moments in the history of our nation. And, you know, like one of those other world events when we're on the precipice of some real disaster and people have to stand up here and just sort of think, you know, about their children, their grandchildren. I mean, really, you want to have, you know, after hundreds of years of trying to build and improve on an American democracy, you just want to throw that all away?
Well, just in closing, you and I have chosen to be in this country. And,
yeah,
you know, it just breaks my heart to see what's happening to the possibility of the end of American democracy. And just to sort of finish up on this idea of Surkoff, the political technologist who's been so successful for image making with in terms of Putin, is there an explanation? I'm in the journalism business, and I've never seen propaganda before. I mean, you know, I used to, back during the Cold War, you know, I met a lot of journalists in in the Soviet Union from TASS and Pravda and understood that they they were forced to be propagandists. But the idea that we, in America, you have volunteer propaganda in the form of Fox and other outlets, that's what I find so disturbing and so frightening, that it's not just Trump's skills that you've outlined very eloquently, it's the echo chamber that bothers me.
Well, it's also because of the whole commercialization of the press. I mean, obviously, there's a big struggle. You know, you and I, growing up in Australia, in the United Kingdom, you know, there was like the BBC, the BBC World Service. And of course, you know, your fellow countryman, Rupert Murdoch, you know, wanted to break out of that kind of state monopoly of news, of everyone having the same news from the same source. But that's come at a price. Because just like with the algorithms that we've heard so much about from Facebook, from Francis Hogan, the whistleblower, that they're designed to encourage, you know, people to be more outrageous and to take, you know, kind of hateful stands, because that kind of stokes clicks and, you know, kind of brings in advertising revenue when people are constantly drawn to, you know, something that's very tense and intense, and, you know, separating people out into various, you know, smaller and smaller affinity groups to fight against each other in these online formats. That's the same direction that we've taken in the media, you know, with the advent of cable news and with all of the kind of broadsheets that sort of came out of the, you know, the breakdown of the mainstream press. And, you know, to get advertising revenues, you need eyeballs or you need readers. And people are more and more, you know, kind of wanting to have something that draws their attention. It's usually through outrage, certainly not through apathy. And, you know, there is more of a tendency for people to want more affirmation of their viewpoints, no matter how narrow they are. They don't want to be challenged. And we're seeing this reflecting in polls around Trump himself. You know, the vast majority of people that I've seen in polling who describe themselves Republicans now don't want to see any criticism of Trump, because it's like criticisms of themselves and their views and their opinions. And they want to see ostracized, you know, Republicans, Republican candidates who come out with different viewpoints. So, you know, everything seems to be feeding towards a kind of a perfect storm of the situation that we're describing. We've lost local media. Everything has become on the national level. People are running more and more to outlets that just affirm their own beliefs, and they don't want to be challenged. And they want to have somebody who is their avatar, their champion, you know, to take their own beliefs and their own visions of themselves forward.
Well, Fiona Hill, I thank you so much for joining us here today. We could continue on, but I thank you for the time.
Thank you so much, Ian. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Fiona Hill, who's a senior fellow in the Center on the United States and Europe in the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. She recently served as Deputy Assistant to the President and Senior Director for European and Russian Affairs on the National Security Council from 2017 to 2019, and from 2006 to 2009 served as National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council. And she's the co-author of Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin, and The Siberian Curse, How Communist Planners Left Russia Out in the Cold. And her latest book just out is There's Nothing For You Here, Finding Opportunity in the 21st Century. We can take a brief station break and back discussing how Idaho's Lieutenant Governor, an avid Trumpster, is grabbing the reins of power to issue edicts whenever the more traditional Republican governor leaves town. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Justin Vaughan, the Vice President of GS Strategy Group, who until recently was a professor of political science at Boise State University, where he also served as director of the Center for Idaho History and Politics and conducted several regional and statewide public policy surveys for Boise State School of Public Service. Welcome to Background Briefing, Justin Vaughan.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And what's going on in this peculiar battle going on between Idaho's governor and lieutenant governor? Whenever the governor leaves town, the lieutenant governor issues edicts and takes over, and then the governor has to repair things. Have they come to an understanding, or is it just going to get worse since the lieutenant governor, who seems to be in the mold of Donald Trump, whereas the governor seems to be a more traditional Republican, she's running to replace him in 2022.
Yeah, she's not just running to replace him, she's challenging him directly because he's not officially announced, I don't believe, but will likely run. And so this is kind of a preview for Idahoans of what the actual campaign will look like. And so they got an early start. But to your question, no, I don't think they've come into an agreement. And I imagine we're just going to see more of this. The governor's office here has made it pretty clear that they're not going to stop traveling, as any governor would around the country or even to other countries, just because they're afraid of what, new kind of stunt the lieutenant governor's office might come up with. And so if they're going to continue to travel, and I don't expect the lieutenant governor to, be kind of chastened by the blowback of this recent event or the previous time, I think we'll just see more of the same. It'll just be, different kinds of executive actions on different policy areas.
So in May, it started when Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan issued a surprise executive order banning all local mask mandates. I understand that there weren't even mask mandates in place, were there?
Yeah, not statewide. The governor actually has never issued a statewide mask mandate, but that doesn't stop some of his opponents from saying that he has. And different cities have, and federal buildings have to operate by federal rules. But the governor's really had a kind of a hands-off approach in the sense of different communities should make decisions for those communities, and so he didn't invalidate, say, the city of Boise, Idaho's decision to have a mask mandate, but he also didn't, force anyone else, any other areas to do it. So it was kind of that first attempt to use executive authority while the governor was out of town was, kind of misguided in the sense that it wouldn't have really accomplished all that much.
Well, it does appear to be grandstanding, but I saw an interview that she did, the lieutenant governor, with CNN, where she walked away from the camera and called the reporter an activist when he was just asking very traditional political questions. I mean, so what is it about her? I mean, she seems to be in the mold of the Trump wing, and could you make the case that what's happening in Idaho is a sort of microcosm of the battle between the old and the new GOP?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. And Idaho is a dark red state. There's barely a Democratic Party to speak of in the state, and so the real contests in elections and in policymaking, consistently and for years, have come about down to kind of the establishment GOP against to kind of the far right. And that far right has morphed and changed over the years, but in the last few years, during the Trump administration, they've really kind of crystallized in this kind of Freedom Caucus style Republican that are kind of not only against liberal social policy that Democrats might put forward, but even they turn the barrels on the business community from time to time, and so it's this kind of anti-government attitude, more than just very conservative form of government. And these conflicts happen persistently, but over the last couple of years, the lieutenant governor has become kind of the elected face, at least, of that far right faction. And it's not always been that way. She was a legislator for many years, and was known as kind of a pretty responsible, pretty certainly conservative, but also, functional, serious legislator, and took some time away from legislature and then ran for lieutenant governor. And, since then, has really kind of become kind of the face of this, far right anti-government activist group. And, it's become even more stark and over the last few months as she's declared her candidacy for governor and really focused on beginning that campaign early.
So, Justin, since you're a Republican strategist, what do you see then as the future of the party in terms of the kind of candidates are going to win? I mean, it's pretty clear from the rally that Trump did on Saturday in Iowa that he's running in 2024, and he seems to control the GOP. So would that mean that the lieutenant governor could beat the incumbent governor, who's a more traditional, old-school Republican?
Well, it certainly doesn't hurt the lieutenant governor to, be aligned with the Trump wing of the party. You know, the relative influence, you know, waxes and wanes, and you know, you never necessarily know exactly how far that brand is going to stretch and how engaged he's going to get in one particular race or another. You know, if I was running for office, I would prefer not to have to run against President Trump and his kind of team. But that doesn't necessarily mean you're not gonna win. You know, if you're running in a red state or a red district, and you're a kind of an authentically conservative person who is, you know, in step with the median voter or the median GOP voter, if you're talking about a primary, then you're still in pretty good shape, right? And at the end of the day, people vote for the people who represent their wishes and represent their policy preferences. And so behaving in a Trumpy kind of way can get some attention, but ultimately, you know, if the incumbent in this case is a better, more solid bet for somebody who wants to have a functional government with conservative values, then the incumbent's going to be okay.
So since you are a strategist for Republican candidates, what are you hearing about how do Republicans, how do they respond to what's happening in Washington? They must be rubbing their hands with glee at the fact that the Democrats are in this terrible stalemate caused by their own members of their own party, that they could sink Biden's agenda and render the Democrats vulnerable in 2022, let alone 2024.
Yeah, I think if we had said, you know, 6 months ago, hey, let's predict, you know, a situation in which Biden's not going to get his infrastructure bill, is not going to get his reconciliation bill, you know, is on his heels, who's responsible for it? We'd probably say Mitch McConnell, right? But Mitch McConnell is just kind of waiting in the wings, and meanwhile, it's the factions of the Democratic Party that are, you know, causing the president sleepless nights.
So in the last couple of minutes, it's a little off topic, but I'm curious because it's in the news now that the Agriculture Department killed a bunch of wolf pups in a den, and it's got the state really upset, or a lot of people in the states, and particularly in your former university and a high school in Boise had adopted these wolf cubs. So what's going on there with this business of wanting to kill wolves in Idaho?
Yeah, you know, and I will admit at the outset, I have not followed this issue closely. I've seen an article or two, but wolves and you know, maintaining wolf packs and wolf depredation is a major issue, major cultural issue in this part of the West. And you know, you have on one hand people who are, you know, sympathetic to animals and especially, you know, pups. But then on the other hand, you have ranchers and farmers that are, you know, they see their livestock and their, you know, fortunes affected by wolves. And so it's really kind of become a cultural cleavage, you know, and for every person who's going to have a full-throated defense of a wolf, you know, and a pack's ability to exist, there's going to be one that says, we shouldn't have any of them. They're dangerous creatures, right? The linkage between with the school and the sponsorship of the wolf pack, and that, you know, adds a particular a new wrinkle to it, and you know, a sad one for those kids. But it's kind of a long-standing debate that's been happening here for decades, you know, and just kind of reared its head in a particularly sad way this time.
And in May, Idaho's Governor Brad Little signed a law allowing the killing of up to 90% of the state's 1,500 wolves. So there can't be too many wolves left if they are killing the pups. I thank you for joining us, Justin. I appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Justin Vaughan, who's the vice president of GS Strategy Group, who until recently was a professor of political science at Boise State University, where he also served as director of the Center for Idaho History and Politics and conducted several regional and statewide public policy surveys for Boise State School of Public Service. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. If you missed any of today's program or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. When we also encourage you to rate and review us on those platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. To help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all, please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing at backgroundbriefing.org. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by 5:30.